mainstream media.
Hello, this is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, December 13th, 2024. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble.ca's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. This week on the show, Eleanor Wand sits down with Dr. Alexander Cotterella, the CEO of the Canadian Centre on Substance Use and Addiction, to talk about the benefits and misconceptions of supervised consumption sites and how whole communities must work together to discover what feels safe for all. Dr. Alexander Cotterella is a bilingual family physician with specialty training in substance use and health issues. He joined the Canadian Centre on Substance Use and Addiction as CEO in August of 2022. Here are Wand and Cotterella in conversation. Take a listen.
So thank you so much for joining me this week on Rabble Radio.
Thank you for having me.
So to start off, could you tell me a little bit about the Canadian Centre on Substance Use and Addiction, as well as what your role is there?
So CCSA, as it's known, has been around since 1988. And we were created because there was this recognition that when it came to issues like addictions and substance use, you needed advice from outside government. It was a little too polarizing, a little too political. So we were created as an arm's length agency. And we're supposed to bring forward best practices. We're supposed to advise governments of all stripe, nationally, federally, but also provincially, territorially. And also in our legislation, we're supposed to help increase the participation of Canadians in really addressing these issues. So we end up doing a lot of work. We did, for example, the alcohol guidance that came out, a lot of work around cannabis, gambling, a lot around treatment and harm reduction as well, workplace support. And we really try and paint the picture of what is the drug situation in this country. So that in a nutshell is a lot of what we end up doing. I'm the CEO there, and I'm also a family doctor by background.
So one of the reasons we are having this conversation today is sort of because of Ontario's impending ban on supervised consumption and treatment service sites that operate within 200 meters of daycares or schools. This decision is going to force 10 of the 19 sites that are currently operating in the province to close. So to maybe start with some context, when we're talking about a supervised consumption site, what are we actually talking about there?
Thanks. I'm really glad you're looking to clarify some of that, because I think that's one of the first things people struggle with is what are we actually talking about? So a supervised consumption site, sometimes it's also known, especially in Europe, as a drug consumption room, these are basically places where people will bring their drugs, their illegal drugs that they've purchased from the street, and use it in a way where they are supervised very frequently by medical professionals, so that if they have an overdose or if they have other kinds of bad effects from it, somebody can respond to it. And for the most part, there are places where people go to inject drugs. There has been an increasing push, as we've seen a lot of people switch, especially around fentanyl and opioids, from injection to smoking drugs. There's been a push to try and get more and more sites to be able to take people who can smoke drugs. But as you can imagine, from a kind of workplace safety, you know, for the nurses and different things, there's a lot of investment and pieces that need to go into that. So that's the main purpose of it, is really to catch people who are overdosing and help them. And for the most part, really, it's not only to help them, it's like keep them out of hospital. Like a lot of the times, even if somebody overdoses, they can manage it there. The person doesn't need to go to the emergency department. What has been really useful across the world is that that is often used as the first connection point to often some form of treatment or broader healthcare. So a lot of places, it's where they might get tested or diagnosed with HIV or hepatitis C infections, or even just get primary care and other things that might keep them out of the hospital. But it's also where treatment can be offered. So for example, I used to work near it at OnSite, which was above InSite in Vancouver, we would take people in for withdrawal management or detox, who were picked up in who were kind of offered that when they were at the supervised consumption site. We would start them on things like buprenorphine, Suboxone, which is opioid agonist treatment, and kind of begin their treatment journey. So often it was kind of that supervised consumption site serve as this kind of warm handshake that people have that allows them to come into the health system when they're pretty apprehensive to show up there.
I guess the next question is, what do you make of this decision? What do you make of the decision to close down some of these sites in the province?
I think where you've seen there's been some really interesting research published lately about, the potential impacts and who's not going to have access to it. I think that we need to spend a lot of time thinking about why this is happening. And it's kind of easy to blame or vilify governments who make these decisions. I think when it comes to instances like this, we really need to ask ourselves why this has a lot of broad public support. See, like people are increasingly not feeling safe in their neighborhoods and their communities. They are in their minds blaming a lot of this on things like supervised consumption sites. And I think they're asking their elected officials to limit them and have them shut down. So why is this happening? And then I think we can really have a conversation about how we meaningfully address these concerns people have so that sites like these can coexist, as other healthcare sites do, with neighborhoods and with people broadly in a really healthy way.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned something there that I wanted to talk about, to touch on. We reached out to the Ministry of Health, and they've said that this decision, as you've mentioned, sort of reflects the concerns that people have in the province. They say that families are facing harassment, physical assault, children are picking up needles or drugs in the schoolyard. And they say really that this decision is about protecting families, protecting children, responding to the concerns of the people that they're hearing from. I mean, do you think that this is a real concern that these sites are contributing to, children being exposed to drugs, as people say, and as the government is citing?
So I think the literature that's been published up till now, the good part is it really shows, and this isn't just in Canada and the US, but it does show that there is less violence and probably less homicides in the areas where supervised consumption sites exist. I think the tricky part is this isn't matching up with, again, what those neighbors feel like they're seeing with their eyes and experiencing themselves. So we've had communities, we were in a Northern Ontario community not too long ago that had very keenly put in an application for a supervised consumption site. And now all of a sudden, people not only weren't supportive, they by all no means wanted it there. So we got to ask ourselves, okay, why are people seeing this? Because I think we're hearing from it consistently enough that people are feeling that gaslit a little bit if we tell them they're really not seeing, they're seeing this with their eyes, right? So why are they seeing it? What's happening? What's going on? So one of the first things that's important to know is, I mean, supervised consumption sites have been around for a long time. We talk about in Europe, I mean, they've been around since the 80s, obviously in Canada since the late 90s, early 2000s, we've had some form of these. So why now all of a sudden? The first thing that we think we really need to look at is and understand is that the drugs have changed. So we used to have plant-based drugs, things like cocaine, heroin. Now we have synthetic drugs. Things like fentanyl and methamphetamines. They're way more potent. They're also a lot cheaper and easier to get. That's not going away, but it's something that we've seen globally around the world. So drugs are more prevalent. And I think the behaviors linked to the drugs are a little bit more unpredictable, especially when it comes to things like methamphetamine. It doesn't necessarily, and really, like I work with folks like this all the time, it doesn't necessarily mean people are going to be more violent. It doesn't mean people are going to be, it does mean that, you're going to see more, for example, psychosis or mental health problems linked to the drugs. You're going to see more unpredictable kind of behaviors. And these might be interpreted in a problematic way. So you have that piece. You have the fact that our treatments in the fentanyl era have been a little less effective. And then that's overlaid on top of a broader kind of housing issue where you have both, I think, an increase in the number of people who are experiencing with food and housing insecurity, but also how visible it is to people. So naturally, those folks are going to congregate around things like supervised consumption. I was really taken by something the head of the European Union Drugs Agency, which is a similar agency to CSA, but in Europe, was talking about. He's somebody who's been working in the treatment and harm reduction sector since the 80s. Says, you know, when we talk about harm reduction, we talk about these services, we talk about them almost as if we're still in that kind of 90s and early 2000s time. We need to be talking about broader risk reduction. And again, it doesn't really matter to people if violence is increasing or decreasing. What matters is if they feel like their neighborhoods are less safe. Right now, people are feeling like their neighborhoods are less safe. And I have a few thoughts on how that can be addressed too.
Yeah, I mean that would be my follow-up. I mean, how do you address that? How do you balance people's concerns, people's feelings in their communities, in their neighborhoods with these services that are, crucial for some people who rely on them?
So I think first of all, this discussion about, you know, where things should be and if they should be anywhere is one we need to be having. I
Right.
mean, my kid goes to public school. They have been trying to build a new public school for him and his classmates for years now. And they are in constant negotiations with the neighborhood about where that needs to go and what it needs to look like. And that's something that everyone accepts needs to happen. You need to have a school. So I think some back and forth and frankly some disagreement is normal. I think that we need to scratch a little bit at the surface of what people need to feel safer. I don't think it's necessarily making it all invisible, as I think sometimes has been talked about. But what do they feel? What would satisfy that need adequately? Because these sites existed for a long time without necessarily having a lot of public concern. So what changed? Sometimes it's just about more appropriate funding and linkages to care. So if, for example, they're tied in well to healthcare settings or places where people can get treatment, but also if they're funded well enough to, for example, have workers outside making sure that things are clean, making sure that things aren't discarded, but also even just having enough money to have a good outreach budget so that you're not just taking care of what's happening in the building, but you're taking care of what's happening outside the building. And I know that this is where there's a push and pull. And I know a lot of advocates will say, you know, that the risk of death is so high that we just need them. We need them intense. We need them everywhere. I think the counter to that is I think what we're seeing now. I think we're seeing the public pushing back, the public discomfort. And I think that the risk is really of losing all of these sites when we know that they can be really, really good linkages into care. So I think it's kind of how they're funded, how they're operated, but also just how they engage with and deal with the community and the neighborhood. I think that there was a quite prominent shooting outside of South Riverdale Community Health Center now quite some time ago. That used to be my neighborhood when I was living in Toronto. And what really struck me in all the interviews that people gave to the media after that, they were saying, we want people to get well. We want people to do well. We're not opposed to having these things, but we just need to be able to feel safe and secure. And we need to know that people are going to access services that are going to help them get better. And I think this is, again, I think that's really addressable, but we need to listen and we need to spend a lot of time listening. One of the things CCSA is doing is we're actually engaging with small cities and towns from across the country. We had our first summit in Timmins in the fall. We're putting together what's called a municipal leadership table. It's a bit of a different way of doing stuff. These are going to be mayors and city councilors going to hear from experts from across the country. They're going to decide what are appropriate menus of options for their small cities and towns. This is important for a couple of reasons. I mean, first of all, is small cities. I mean, we focus a lot on Toronto and Ottawa and Vancouver, but these places, they do have a lot of death, but their rates of death and overdose are often much lower than, you know, places like Timmins, rural places, northern places that are left to their own devices. They're not going to have millions of dollars to lift up big, robust, rich services. So what does this actually look like? What does it look like to build capacity locally amongst different agencies? And we want to help them not only come up with a meaningful menu of options of what good services could look like, but also I think helping them understand what community is ready for what. There is a reality that some communities may be more ready for things like a supervised consumption site than others. And I think we also need to understand how do we get people to that state of readiness. sometimes it's ideologic where people just need to know that, and again, we can have disagreements on why people use drugs and what it is, but some people, it's really important to them to know that that linkage to care and treatment exists so that you're helping people when they're ready access those and eventually either use substances in a less harmful way or stop using them at all. And then there's other communities that are kind of just ready for it, but they just need to make sure that they feel safe when they walk their kids to school. And again, I think we focus a lot on, are they actually safe? Are they not? Doesn't matter, right? We got to meet people where they're at. We've been saying that when it comes to clients all the time, but now we got to meet neighborhoods where they're at. They don't feel safe. That's what matters. And telling them that they're safe when they don't feel safe isn't going to work. So we got to find ways to make them feel safe and feel that the services being offered to clients are actually going to help people get better. And we can say till we're blue in the face that this evidence or that evidence, but people are kind of done with experts. They don't want to be sermoned by experts anymore. They want to hear, and they want to, frankly, like see and believe.
I mean, it sounds like you're saying that the sort of dismissal of people who feel unsafe is actually, doing more harm than good. And that's sort of why we're seeing the policy changes that we're seeing is because there is sort of two camps, but not someone in the middle trying to bridge the two.
Yeah, I worked in hospital for a long time with it would always be so interesting. Like we would have very marginalized clients come in and they would often leave the emergency without being seen or they'd leave, what we used to call against medical advice, or kind of self-discharge really early before their infections, various things could be treated. And sometimes they were treated badly by hospital staff, but a lot of the time there was like a perception, there was a feeling like they were being really stigmatized and treated badly. And I would go to the staff and I'd say, this person left because they didn't. And we would talk about the fact that, what actually happened is important, but how it left them feeling is more important. And ultimately it affects if whether they're going to engage in care or not. I think it's the same thing with our neighborhoods, right? And so this is why things like even things like diversion of safe supply drugs, that has been a big media story for a long time, right? These kinds of things, like, again, what is happening, how much it's actually happening, how much it's actually affecting the overall drug market. Same with the supervised consumption sites, how much it's actually contributing to versus just a lot making more visible these issues is like, it doesn't really matter. It's like how it makes people feel. And you're right. If they don't feel like the scientists and the public institutions are listening to them, we've seen people are not going to hesitate to go to their politicians and say, just toss it. We don't want this stuff anymore. So we need to ask ourselves as scientists and public health experts, what are we explaining in a way that people aren't understanding? Where is that disconnect happening? And how do we meaningfully bridge that? And again, I know many people say, well, we don't have time for that. But I think the alternative is to be left with none of these things. And I think that kind of makes me sad, but I think it's even sadder to think that the public doesn't have faith in our health institutions. We need to regain a little bit of that. And I think there's some organizations like ours who are really trying to create more opportunities for people to be connected.
I mean, that would be my next question to you, really, is the short-term concern and risk that many advocates are talking about is, we don't have time for this. We know that there are going to be more people who die as a result of that. How would you respond to that?
So I think you need people in every part of the spectrum, right? There's reasons that legal challenges are happening. There's reasons that you need advocates that can articulate, I think the real urgent needs on the ground. And then, I feel like I fit into that spectrum in a way as someone who is here to kind of try and argue the long-term sustainability of some of these things. We got to look at this crisis. I mean, like now 8 years since some of this overdose crisis was declared, like this isn't going away in 6 months. So we got to think long term. We got to think about things, not things that we can lift up for 3 months. We got to think about things that we can lift up for 12 months, for years and years, right? It may be uncomfortable to say, but we're going to need the public buy-in for that. When it comes, for example, to the cancer system, right? Like the public's bought into that really well. And it's like no one's questioning, no one's saying, oh, you can't have surgery, you only need chemotherapy, you can't have this, you can't have that. they've been okay leaving that to the health system to kind of decide, but also triage who gets what and how many of what we need. And I don't know that that was always the case. I think when the health system had to earn a lot of that. So I hear the urgency, and I think people should very much not only feel free to speak their mind, but speak up on behalf of their clients. And I think neighbors need to speak up on behalf of what they're seeing. And I think we need to find ways. One of the things I'll say that's super interesting is when we as an organization actually pull people together. So, we had a summit, for example, on what role families can have. We had people in that room who were provincial harm reduction coordinators and people in that room who had drug-free in the name of their organization. And they got along. Like they just wanted to find real. So like I think when you break stuff down and you start talking about real things to real people, and you start actually meaningfully engaging them in what's happening in their communities, that kind of polarization falls apart. I was really touched actually to see people working together. That's a bit why we're focusing on, yes, national priorities, yes, national strategy, but local solutions. We really want to be working a lot with communities. And I think this is where we can't tell people exactly what they need in their community. We also can't tell them what they can't have. So I think blanket bans aren't going to work. And I think forcing everyone to say, every community needs a supervised consumption site, or no community is allowed to have a supervised consumption site, like neither of those are going to work. When we look at jurisdictions successfully tackled this, they've like listened to their local situations and they've recognized that the situation in Cambridge is going to be different than the situation in Toronto. It's going to be different than the situation in Timmins, different than the situation in Saskatoon, et cetera, right?
I mean, we're almost sort of at our time here. So before I let you go, are there any sort of final thoughts that you would like to leave the audience with?
I think it's normal for people to feel really frustrated. I think that's what we're hearing. It's a frustration, right? People are upset that there's violence. People are upset because things aren't working. People are upset because people are dying. And I think we got to break through that, and we got to work on the collaboration piece. Sometimes we got to recognize sometimes we do have different goals, and that's okay. But we got to find a way to work together on a lot of these pieces. And I think the other piece is we got to find a way that everyone, and I genuinely believe this, like everyone has a role to play. I think some of this frustration comes from the fact that people are seeing this in the newspaper all the time. It used to be somebody knew somebody who knew somebody who knew somebody who died. Now it's like everybody knows someone who's died. So they're affected by this. They want to do something. We got to show them what they can do. I think that's where that hope comes from. So there are the people that work on the front line of healthcare. There are the people who work on the front line of social services, harm reduction services. We got to go beyond that. What is the role for educators? What is the role for teachers? What is the role for municipal politicians? What is the role for parks and recreational, people? What is the role? Like everyone, and I truly believe it, whether it's on the prevention side, whether it's on the treatment side, the harm reduction side, we all have to work together, but we also have a role to play. And I think if you're not sure what your role is, check out our organization and engage with us, because we really want to help you find a way to manage this and to tackle this. And ultimately, I think we will, as every society that has kind of come to some better place around this, we'll recognize that there's a role for everything across the spectrum. And I think we're gonna find a way through this, and we're gonna have some hope. But I think it may get bumpier before it doesn't.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today on Rabble Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much.
That was Dr. Alexandra Cotterella from the Canadian Centre on Substance Use and Addiction and Rabble.ca's Jack Layton Journalism for Change Fellow, Eleanor Wand. Thanks so much for that, Eleanor and Alexander. And now for our In Case You Missed It segment, here is Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Take it away, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. Starting in Ontario news this week, Conservative Premier Doug Ford is going ahead with his plan to close most of Ontario's supervised drug consumption sites, despite a report from Ontario's Auditor General that points out serious flaws in the logic behind such a move. The Auditor General's report, which was released last Tuesday, said that the decision to replace consumption sites was made without proper planning, analysis, or public consultation. It also concluded that the Ford government does not have effective processes in place to meet the challenging nature of the opioid crisis in Ontario. Danielle Werb, director of the Center on Drug Policy Evaluation, in a previous interview with Rabble.ca, said that there was no evidence that supervised consumption sites posed any risk to the public. Staying in provincial news, in Quebec, Sven Stelmach is calling on Premier François Legault to acknowledge that the province has a problem with systemic racism. Stelmach, a black man and Uber driver, fell victim to racial profiling after a Montreal police officer pulled him over without cause and implied that he had stolen the vehicle he was driving, which was, of course, not the case. Section 636 of the Quebec Highway Traffic Code allowed police officers to pull over drivers without cause. This led to black men being subjected to racial profiling. Another notable example of this being Joseph Christopher Luamba, who was stopped over a dozen times by Quebec police officers but was never arrested or received a single ticket. Organizations like the Canadian Civil Liberties Union argued successfully in court that Section 636 violated Canada's Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Premier Legault, however, continues to publicly deny that racial bias exists in Quebec. And finally, join us next week for Rabble.ca's final political panel of 2024. In next week's Off the Hill panel, we'll review the highs and lows of 2024 in Canada, the US, and globally. 2024 was a big year, from the shocking US election to the ongoing genocide in Gaza to a shifting political scene in Canada and more. There's much to discuss. Join guests NDP Member of Parliament for Vancouver Kingsway Don Davies, economist Jim Stanford, activist and writer Clayton Tomlins-Mueller, activist and professor P.K. Much, and Rabble's labor reporter Gabriella Kaluga-Kasuga in conversation next week. Register to save your spot for this panel on Rabble.ca today. And as always, you can read the full version of all the stories we talked about today and more on Rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on Rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.